Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. Welcome back to another episode of The Lobbying Show. Today we are here in the first week of March, and Washington did come together and pass a legislative package dealing with the coronavirus. So it shows that they can come together on important matters. And as state legislatures continue to meet across the country, states grappling with how to deal with the coronavirus, trying to strike that balance between not panicking and not being stupid, if you will. We've seen some companies restrict travel. Just saw that some companies are having their employees stay home and work remotely in certain cities. And so, but across the country, the state legislatures continue to meet. We were at a public hearing just yesterday, and people had flown in from Washington, D.C. and I think other places to testify. So it's this unsettling time, this weird time of not really knowing where to draw the line, and should you just go on with your life, or where do you draw the line, and how do you be safe? So to all you lobbyists out there, most of you are in the middle of your sessions and are extremely busy, and we wish you all the best. Today we bring you Doug Pinkham. Doug is the head of the Public Affairs Council. He has been running it essentially forever, for over 20 years. The Public Affairs Council has a number of conferences throughout the year, and he brings people together, and it's really a lot of different lobbying firms, grass tops, PR firms, and he brings them all together and helps teach them the latest best practices in public affairs. And it's a networking organization, opportunity to see people, see and hear what other people are doing. And it was just really enjoyable to sit down with them. So here is Doug Pinkham. I hope you enjoy the episode. So Doug, good morning. So glad to have you here. Thank you for stopping by.
I'm happy to do it.
Tell us about the Public Affairs Council.
All right. Well, the Public Affairs Council has been around since 1954, originally suggested by Dwight Eisenhower. He's not quite our founder. He's the guy who recommended, but we do have a bust of him.
Oh, you do. And when a president makes a recommendation,
yeah, you listen.
And you're in Washington, you listen.
That's right. And basically his idea was that he had been, one of the things that had helped him get elected was a lot of young business people who had campaigned for him. And he said, you know, the business community needs to be more engaged in government and more engaged in greater society. Now, there's some people now who would say, perhaps companies are too engaged in government and society. But back then, if you are a company and you faced a regulatory or legislative issue, you hired someone at the last minute to try to, you know, who knew the right senator to try to cut a deal. Or if you faced a reputational crisis, you hired a crisis management company to come in and solve things. Now, some people still do that. But back then, it was rare to be more strategic about your engagement with government and your engagement in greater society. Terms like corporate social responsibility didn't exist. And honestly, there wasn't a lot of strategy except for just a few big firms. So we were created as a civic organization originally as a way of encouraging greater business involvement. And in the 60s, we morphed into a full-service professional society. What's unusual is our business model is not typical, and that like a trade association, the company or the nonprofit member is the member, not the person. But like a professional society, our job is to support this profession. So we have roughly 740 member organizations around the world, mostly U.S., but not exclusively, and about 12,000 people active in our work.
And then how, and you don't have to tell me exactly, but how do you determine what dues are? Is it based on employees, on revenue, on...
For companies, it's based on revenue size, you know, size of your revenue. Mm-hmm. For member consultants, law firms, public affairs firms, vendors, and for associations, it's based on staff size.
Okay.
Basically, you have a big and a small size for each one of those. But And then we have other, you know, non-corporate organizations. Like, we have about 7 or 8 universities who are members. We have one government organization, interestingly, the Danish Foreign Ministries. They do things very efficiently in Denmark. This is like an amalgamation of a State Department and Commerce Department. One of the things that they do is proactively go out and help identify countries where Danish businesses could do business, and they help make relationships to aid them in their business development. So if you work for Novo Nordisk or Legos or one of the other big Danish companies, that's an active role of government. So it's a really interesting model. And they decided that, you know, one of the skill sets they needed to learn was stakeholder engagement and communications and global relationship building. And that's one of the areas we do, you know, programming in.
And so you have about, 100 conferences, seminars, education?
Yeah, about 100, 120 conferences in the U.S. and in Europe.
And when you think about, and these would cover all different topics from grassroots to whatever it may be.
Yeah, the vast majority of them are something related to public policy. Let me just say, we take a broad definition of public affairs.
Okay.
And I should just say, spend a minute explaining definitions here, because in the U.S., public affairs means lots of things. You know, Meet the Press is one of those public affairs programs they have on Sunday morning.
Right.
If you work in the federal government and you are the assistant secretary for public affairs in some agency, you do media relations mostly, or communications. In some companies, public affairs is an inclusive area, you know, external relations of all types, CSR, public relations, and government affairs. In other companies, a senior VP of public affairs is, you know, is lobbying and advocacy. So there's sort of a definitions issue. Around the world, it is more common than not to have the head of this function have responsibility for everything external. Interestingly, in the U.S., it's not as common. It used to be. But now maybe 35-40% of companies have communications, CSR, and government affairs all under one person. In much of Europe and in Australia, it's more like 80% report to one person. But we take that broad definition because we feel that the public doesn't read org charts. You know, they don't care who reports to whom.
Right.
All they know is what you said and what you did. And if you're saying one thing in your communications area and something different in your public policy world, that's not so good. And so it's a way of emphasizing the importance of having an integrated strategy, even if you don't have an integrated structure.
And what are some of the skills that you teach at these seminars?
Well, that's why I say it's everything from crisis management to compliance, American campaign finance laws, or it could be Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, lobbying registration rules, state advocacy trends and issues. We have large conferences on PACs and campaign finance, a large one called the Advocacy Conference, which is all major strategies in support of advocacy, including, you know, social media, digital advocacy.
Where you teach best practices?
Absolutely. And it's a big enough meeting. We have over 400 people at our two biggest meetings, that and the PAC conference. And we're able to have education tracks focusing on communication strategies that somehow relate to, like business support for social issues is obviously a huge thing you see these days, you know, talking about that and impact of reputation on the regulatory environment. More direct lobbying, and then another one on grassroots. We used to have a grassroots conference, and it eventually just got so big that we expanded the definition and called it the Advocacy Conference.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So if I'm in-house, I'm a member and coming to these conferences to learn how to coordinate my message, learn best practices, but you also have public affairs firms and people that belong and come.
That's right.
And are they, do you think they're focused on best practices or best practices and networking or all the above? Or?
It's all the above.
Okay.
You know, a lot of people talk to people they know in their own industry at their trade association meetings. We're one of the few groups where you can come to an event and hear from the Mayo Clinic and AARP and, you know,
and the government of Denmark.
And the government of Denmark, exactly. And also consultants, law firms. There's a lot of people who move from not just company to company, but move into the trade association world, back to a corporate office, into the government, you know, working for another nonprofit. And, you know, we're trying to follow those people wherever they work. And because of the fact we're not an advocacy organization, which is one of those things that's really hard to explain at Thanksgiving, you know, when relatives say, what is it you do? You're in Washington. Do you work for the government? Well, no. Are you a lobbying group? Well, no. And then I say I'm on K Street, and they say, well, you're lying because you must be a lobbying group. And do you have members? And they say, well, mostly big companies. Well, then you have to be a lobbying group. So we don't fit neatly into categories because we're not only nonpartisan, we're non-political. It's all about smart ideas, best practices, innovations. We do public polling research to talk very candidly about what the public thinks about lobbying, what they think about big companies, and what they think about CEO compensation even. Because companies need to understand the issues they're facing and what's coming around the corner, what are the challenges they face. And thank goodness, I don't have to get my members to agree on anything other than like the budget, and we're doing okay on that, because I don't think I could certainly from a public policy standpoint. In healthcare alone, we have probably every cause represented pretty much, and you can imagine how many there are. And so they put their issues aside and they come and learn and, like I said, share smart ideas and best practices.
Yeah, and I want to get to the Pulse survey report that you just released, but I wanted to just touch base on, so when you are, how do you decide what the best practice is for grassroots digital campaigns? Do you reach out to some of your members who have an expertise in that area and they present, or how do you decide?
Well, that's a mystery. I'm not allowed to tell you how we do this. It's a secret recipe. Actually, you know what it is we do a lot of casework, which a lot of associations don't do these days, where members call us or send us emails and they say, all right, I'm a chemical company and I need a new crisis communications plan. And I've talked to some of my competitors and colleagues. What else is out there? Like, what are tech companies doing? And so because we have access to all the different sectors, we have sample crisis plans or a grassroots strategy or an email from the CEO recommending the corporate PAC, you know, and acknowledging that the employees are cynical about politics. Well, how do you talk about that? Well, they're good examples. And so our members are generous with submitting ideas. Now we will, I used to say white out, but no one knows what white out is anymore. We blank out the name of the company or the association, and we have a digital library and show people samples, and we have a staff of experts, kind of like a law firm does, in that, you know, you've got practice areas, someone who specializes in state and local, international, grassroots and digital, and so forth. And so they spend time. But what we also do is we track not only who calls us for help, and we tell them at dues renewal time, you called us 12 times, so that kind of helps. Because sometimes the boss isn't aware of how much their staff is using us.
Yep.
But you also see patterns. And for instance, some years ago in the PAC area, we saw we were getting a lot of questions about PAC match. You know, this is where an association or company says, if you contribute, we'll make a matching donation to these charities. And as that was growing into a thing, we said, okay, we need to do a workshop. And because you have market research and you do a workshop and you get a great turnout. And so that's one way, is by tracking the calls and requests we get. We also go to our own meetings and look at, you know, which breakout sessions do you have to bring extra chairs in, you know, because they're so crowded, and which ones aren't so well attended. And based on that, you focus on the subject. You get referrals from other members of who does it well. We talk to them. And out of all of that, you get the best ideas. Honestly, best practice is really kind of a misnomer, because it's smart practices. In most of these areas, there's not a single way to do it.
Right. Yeah.
But it's a term of art in management. So
yeah,
we
I
often
think smart practices is a good term.
It really is.
Like, and I have to say, the seminars and the conferences that you have really cover the entire gamut. It's quite impressive. And the companies and the people that you have attending is really impressive. It's and I would encourage anyone to go on your website and check out the different offerings that you have. It's quite obvious why you have such a vibrant membership. It's impressive.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it. We work hard.
And you've been working there a while. So
I've been there almost 23 years. But you know, I inherited a good organization too. I didn't like create this whole thing. And there is a culture of, you know, service to the members, but also a commitment to doing things right. In other words, you know, someone cannot buy their way onto, you know, getting a speaking engagement, even if they're a sponsor. We love sponsors. We love the support. And our, you know, our consulting members have realized that, you know, if they get up there and give a presentation and it shows how smart they are and how good they are, that's when you have a line of people
yes.
wanting to talk to them. But if yeah. they do a commercial, then it's a turnoff. And, yep. and so they get that. So, you know, we would be, to your earlier point about involving a wide array of members, consultants, as well as companies. Everybody's a full member. No one's like an associate member. You know, we treat the consultants as well as we treat the big companies, because you've got some of the best minds in this field working in the consulting area.
Well, you do a very good job at pulling them together. So your Pulse report survey, I found it interesting. I mean, I'll let you pick out what you found the most interesting. I found where do you get your news? Friends and family. Mm-hmm. That was interesting. And when is lobbying acceptable? So why don't you talk about the survey? What did you, when you saw the results of this, your survey for 2019,
what
struck you as interesting?
Yeah, well, first thing I'll say is we started this like in 2011 because there was really a dearth of public opinion polling related to businesses' relationship with society and government. And I did an exhaustive search of, you know, what questions are people asking? And it was usually things like, you know, do big companies have too much power? See if you can guess the answer to that. What do you think? Yes.
Maybe.
Oh, here's another one. Do CEOs make too much money? Yeah. And that's still an issue. But nothing about the nuance of how companies, you know, deal with the public and what works and what doesn't. And when they face a crisis, do you forgive them or not? And why? All that kind of areas. And their faith in the federal government versus the state government. So there was a lot of things to explore. This year, some of the new questions.
So where do they have more faith, federal or state?
State.
Okay.
It's like, in other words, and they would have more faith in local than state. So,
so the closer it is to home,
the closer they are. However, I got to say is that public cynicism about government has gotten so bad. And in the federal government, it's down around 29% have a favorable view. And state used to be up around 60. And now that's dropped below 50. Hmm. So that's not good. You know, in other words, there's not even as much faith at the state and local as there used to be. And I don't think it helps anyone to have people lose trust in big institutions. So that's a whole subject area. What we did differently, we always try to do some new questions, which is not easy given the thousands of surveys that are done by other organizations. And I'm very proud when we do that. Like last year, we were the first ones who surveyed the question, which is amazing. No one had asked this. Who reads Trump's tweets? And when he criticizes a company or individual, does it actually make a difference? Because there was a real phenomena when he was first elected and started saying negative things about some big companies like Lockheed and Boeing and of course, Amazon, he picks on a lot because he doesn't like Jeff Bezos owning the Washington Post. Does it have an impact? And initially, it was affecting stock prices. But after a while, not so much. And well, the bottom line is the research showed that in like 80% of the cases, it didn't really have a material impact on people's opinion up or down. And almost as many people said they liked someone or a company that Trump criticized as said they didn't like them after hearing this. Because in fact, more Democrats than Republicans actually follow his tweets, either directly or as reported in the media. So bottom line is, as a company, don't overreact when this happens, especially now. So that was last year. This year, one of the questions we asked, with all this talk about the swamp and draining the swamp in Washington, and I've lived here a long time, and public cynicism about Washington has been high as long as I can remember. And so it occurred to us, well, we should ask, well, what do they mean when they talk about the swamp? Like, what are the behaviors that they really don't like? Is it lobbying? Is it money in politics or what? So we tested 10 different options, things that could be controversial. The top four were all things, frankly, that politicians do. Number one was a politician not voting their conscience, doing something expedient to get reelected as opposed to voting what they think is right. Number two is outright corruption, which, you know, when that happens, obviously people are upset about that. And frankly, it doesn't happen as often as I think a lot of the public assume. And three and four were, you know, too much partisanship. And I forgot what number four was, but it was, do you have it there?
Politicians spending too much time raising money.
Yeah, too much focus on raising money. Now, number five was more of a Republican phenomena among Republican respondents and Democrats. And it was that the news media focuses on the wrong stories and the wrong issues. This is one area where Trump has been very successful in, you know, communicating his ideas, not just to his base, but the Republican Party and quite a few independents too, is, you know, this distrust of the news media. And so there is a real sense of that, and that's considered a problem. Interestingly, again, in the top 10, concern about too many lobbyists, too many causes, that was down the list. And actually number 10 out of the 10 was PACs, which was hugely ironic given the fact that in 2018, a lot of Democratic candidates said, I'm not taking corporate PAC money. And then in this presidential election, a lot of the Democratic candidates for president said they're not taking corporate PAC money. Of course, frankly, very few corporate PACs donate in presidential races. But that was interesting to find out that it's not uncontroversial, but corporate PACs are actually not as big a deal as often the way they're portrayed.
And why do you think lobbyists have a negative connotation? Do you think it's deserved? Why do you think it's...
You know, I'd say it was probably deserved at one point. And, you know, this sense of, you know, the companies used to talk about their Washington offices. Oh, I've got this guy in Washington, and it usually was a guy back then, who knew all the right people, and that was how you got things done. And that just doesn't, it sounds sinister. You know, companies would apologize for having a Washington office. Well, we wish we didn't have to do that, you know, but that's the way the system works, so we got to do it. That does not help in terms of public opinion. And those are just things that companies say themselves. So then you do have scandals like the Abramoff scandal and things like that.
But they're so rare.
They are. Now,
I mean, you know, you've seen the poster where they have the different pictures of the lobbyists, and then they show a picture of a lobbyist in a hearing taking notes,
right,
which you and I know is a big part of the job.
It's not exciting or sinister as people assume. I know it always bothers me when people talk about House of Cards, you know, as this great show. I was so mad just watching the first episode before I, you know, even got into the thing because of the drama and the way it portrayed Washington in general as a bunch of evil people. You know, there's talk that, you know, Veep is a much better representation of politics in Washington, and from what I know of government, absolutely. But there was another show on HBO years ago, and I think George Clooney was executive producer, and it was called K Street. And it would have like little cameo appearances by James Carville and people who worked in politics and some lobbyists, and nobody watched it. And the reason no one watched it, and it only lasted one season, is it was just as boring as you can imagine. It was people getting together and having a meeting about trying to get a Dear Colleague letter written. Well, they didn't write the letter. Now what are we going to do? Well, we're thinking of forming a coalition. Okay, and so that does not make great television. So, I mean, bottom line is it's not nearly as exciting or sinister as people think. But I think it also just sounds, especially when there's money involved, you know, frankly, I think our system of campaign finance laws is some of the best in the world. And I've talked to other countries where, you know, the conflict of interest rules and the lobbying disclosure laws aren't as tough as ours. And often ours, I think, is if not a best practice, it's better than much of the world. But nevertheless, when you have money in politics, it sounds like someone's bribing someone. And again, I'm not saying there hasn't been scandals, and there have. But I think we're now at the point where lobbying and lobbyists are pejorative terms, and there's nothing we can do about that. You know, you can't spend a gazillion dollars on a PR campaign and convince the public, you know, to love their neighborhood lobbyist.
Was there anything else in the survey? I noticed that the how should campaigns be financed? Candidates spending their own money, 70%.
Yeah, people don't have a problem with rich people, as I would put it, spending their own damn money on negative ads, you know, rather than my money or someone else's money. So people find self-funded campaigns acceptable. They obviously find individual contributions acceptable. And then in third place is PACs.
So just to stop you acceptable. There for a second. So just so people know, because they're not looking at it, the contributions from individuals was also essentially at 70%. So that and candidates spending their own money was the same. Contributions from PACs, 50%. Contributions from super PACs, 46%, so 50% we'll say. Using federal tax dollars, 30%.
Yeah, public financing of campaigns. And there are groups who've been working for many years to try to pass public financing of campaigns at the state and national level. And it is just not popular with most people in the public.
To use tax dollars campaigns.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the other thing that came out of there was we asked people about what they think about lobbying. You mentioned that, mm-hmm. you know, because like I said, again, lobbyist is a pejorative term. One of the things we found out, and we've asked this four different times now, and the results have been the same, because I kind of frankly didn't believe it the first time we saw it some years ago, is that when you give a reason of why you're lobbying, the public finds it acceptable. So for instance, if you say we're lobbying to reduce business costs, or to expand markets, or to level the playing field with competitors, which are frankly major reasons why companies lobby and associations lobby. Either majorities or at least pluralities of the public find that perfectly acceptable. Even when you say we're lobbying to try to secure a federal grant, not a majority, but a plurality of the public says that's perfectly acceptable. And I think what it comes down to is that, you know, in anything in business, if you give if you explain why you're doing it, it's true in politics. If you just say as a company, we're doing a layoff and you don't give a reason, well, you know, people aren't going to like that and they don't trust you. But if you say, we're repositioning ourselves. We're going to be laying people off. We're being generous with the severance packages. We hope to be able to start rehiring some people in a few years if business conditions improve. But we want to really be straight about why we're doing this and the factors we face. No, people won't love you for doing that. Wall Street might because they say, oh, you're cutting costs and that's good. But in terms of the general public, they won't love that, but they will find that way more acceptable than if you just don't explain why. If you have a corporate scandal and you're very tight-lipped about it, people will assume you're up to no good. But if you say what you can within legal boundaries, you know, the public will give you the benefit of the doubt. And the same is true for lobbying. Because when you say we're lobbying to level the playing field, it's a verb now. And it's like we're advocating, we're trying to change the environment in which we work. And most people find that perfectly okay. So to my point of you're never going to get people to love the word lobbyist or the word lobbying, but, you know, this is why, you know, you need to talk about it differently.
But if you describe what you're doing, they may feel differently.
Yes. There's a lesson there for, I think, for those of us who work in this field and for our companies that even when you're talking to your own employees about your Washington office, I know some companies who say we have an office in Washington that represents our business interests as opposed to we have a lobbying office in Washington.
How many employees do you have at the...
We have 24.
24, wow.
Mostly in the U.S., but several people in Europe.
And what are most of them responsibilities? Running conferences, I would imagine, is a big
There's a lot of that. I mean, these are difficult jobs, and they keep reminding me of this, you know, some of the mid-level people in our organization, because you are generally a practice area expert. You've worked in managing PACs, and you have campaign finance expertise, or you've run grassroots campaigns for associations, and you are like the internal consultant to our members. But you're also in charge of doing education on those subjects as well.
So you have an in-house, say, grassroots digital whatever expert.
Yes.
And so that person will help oversee the conferences and seminars that you have on that topic. And then in addition to that, take questions and answers from members as they say, hey, I'm doing a campaign on X.
And give speeches. And in fact, Nick DeSarno is our guy in charge of digital advocacy and grassroots. But he plans the major conferences in terms of speaker selection. He moderates panels there. And then, but it's a team. I mean, different people contribute in different areas. We have people who specialize specifically in meeting planning and in marketing and PR and so forth. But it's a big job. And you have to do that. You have to like teaching the subject, not just being the advocate, but being able to expose people to emerging issues and new ideas and like, you know, being like the big expert at the national meeting.
And do you have to speak a lot or teach a lot now? You probably don't
do
much teaching speaking.
I probably give, 50, 60 speeches a year between in-house and externally. I'm sort of the major external face of the organization, but not exclusively. I know when news media call, I always try to encourage our issue experts to take the call. So I keep saying this is not the American Doug Association. You don't have to just promote me. I mean, I have certain areas of expertise of political risk and issues management, and I have a communications background, so I do some of that high-level stuff. But there are people who know way more than I do about digital advocacy, about PAC law and campaign finance rules and lobbying registration and international, certainly. So it's great to be able to shine a light on those staff experts and give them some credibility for what they do.
What part of your job do you like the most?
Boy, it sounds hokey, but managing the people I work with, managing my staff and working with our members. I have a great team of people who work for us. We've been pretty successful of avoiding a lot of office drama. My point is when I'm hiring folks, I always say we don't have a lot of office drama. And you find that if someone looks disappointed, well, then you don't want to hire them, right? Because they're into that. But if someone seems thrilled that you said that, that means they're a very productive person who hates office drama. And my point is we just have too much to do to get bogged down in that. The other thing I got to say about my members, and I realize every association CEO says that, but I really do mean it. They're people I would hang out with for free, and I get paid for this. I hope no one from my compensation committee is hearing this. I'd be willing to work for a pay cut. But they're a bunch of liberal arts graduates who read books, have a sense of humor, and have opinions about everything. I mean, how great is that? So we just got back from our Public Affairs Institute, and it's like an Aspen Institute program. It's like leadership training based on issues rather than how to do so. It's the one non-practical event we do, and it's very high level. And we talk about foreign policy, about privacy issues, about religion and politics, about economics, a whole host of issues. And
for staff and members?
No, just for members.
Just members.
And there are a number of companies like a Walmart and a Target and others who identify who are their rising stars, and those people go to that program. And it is a three-year commitment. So they come for a week. There are very few three-year commitments. A lot of marriages don't last 3 years. So you come for a week for three straight years with the same cohort of 30 people. And by the third year, it's like coming back to public affairs camp. And because there are people who work in all different industries, some of them other countries, but you have the shared experience about talking about security issues or privacy issues or new technology. And then you go out to dinner together and with the faculty. So it's a very unique experience. And I just totally love doing it. That is the favorite program I'm involved in because I get to go every year.
All right. And what is the most difficult part of your job?
Oh, boy. The most difficult part of my job is...
Or a part that you just don't, you know, if you didn't have to do it, you wouldn't miss it.
There's no part, I know this, you're never going to believe this, but there's no part that I would hate to do because I like balance. I was one of those students, I was into writing and English and history, but I didn't mind having math homework.
What was your major?
English literature.
Okay.
But I didn't mind having math homework, you know, because it used a different part of your brain. And I love managing budgets.
Let me get this straight. You were an English lit major?
Yes.
And you like doing math?
Yes.
Okay.
I know, it's
that's
crazy.
Unique.
Well, my wife was in my little college in Ohio, the College of Worcester, where I met her. She was the top math and computer science major. And just at the time in the early days of computers, and she decided, remember the IBM punch cards?
Mm-hmm.
If you drop them, young people have no idea. Ask your grandparents what I'm talking about. If you had your IBM punch cards, which was your software, and on the way out of the computer lab, because there was only one computer on campus, you dropped them, you had to start over, you know, because you could never sort them out. She hated that. So she switched to art history. As I like to say, it's something that, you know, better for one's career and salaries, right?
And more fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
the opposite.
Not salary, but more fun.
But so it's the same way. And both my sons are the same way. They're eclectic learners. So I actually, there's no part of my job I really hate. I think the hardest thing for me is taking my ambitions and my vision of all the things we could do and I'd love to do, and then matching them up with, who's on my team? Do I have the talent? You know, are people trained to do the job?
You can't do as much as you'd like.
You can never do as much as you want. You know, the members, we do surveys of what they want us to do. Sometimes what they ask for isn't, you know, mostly it's in alignment, but sometimes not. But that's okay. You know, this is why it's an association. It's not my business. And so most of the time, my biggest problem is biting off more than I can chew and trying to do too much and needing to slow down a little bit.
Do you have internships
in
the office? You do?
We do.
Can you tell us about those? How do people apply? How do they find them?
Yeah, our philosophy toward interns is either they should get credit for it or they should get paid.
Okay.
We don't believe in doing just free internships, you know, indentured
servitude.
And do you
do during the summer or year round?
We do it year round, but we don't always have one in every position because we're not that big a staff.
Right.
And if we don't have, you know, if we're in between people or the person's really busy, if they can't devote the time to overseeing an intern, we don't want someone just floating around looking for something to do. We've had very good success with interns and they've gone on to all kinds of great other careers, and we try to give them meaningful work, but we also are very selective. They've got to have some, you know, writing skills and comfortable on the phone and research skills and work well with others. So
when you came out of school, you were going to be a journalist?
That's right.
And what did you do? What was your first job out of college?
Well, my first job in college, I had the greatest internship working for Oregon Public Television. Again, I went to school in Ohio, went out to Portland, Oregon, late 70s, working for the Public Television Network for a semester. And they were really understaffed and had just started a new evening news public affairs show. And I started writing for it and I started producing for it within 2 weeks. And within a month, I was on the air. So that's pretty heady experience for a 20-year-old. And then they had me come back over vacations and I did that. But then I decided I didn't really want to live out there, at least at that point. I might change my mind now. Air travel is a lot more affordable. But, you know, I was editor of my high school and my college newspaper, as news director of my college radio station. So I did all those things. But I loved writing. But one thing I discovered early on is I loved writing more than reporting. In other words, I love composing, you know, writing stuff that was, you know, smart, clever, interesting. But mostly what a journalist does, they spend more time digging for news than they actually spend writing the news. And so I was thinking about, well, maybe I should do magazine work or long-form journalism. One of the things I noticed at the public TV station is when some of those folks left for jobs in PR, they were really, really happy. I'm thinking, okay, why is that? If they've always wanted to be a journalist. Well, sometimes it was pay. Sometimes it was just deadline pressure. You know, it just wears you down. And one of the things I noticed about working with journalists, and I have journalists as friends, so this is not a slam on journalists, is that to be a good reporter, you've got to be a skeptical person. If you do it too long under very bad working conditions, like bad pay, long hours, skepticism can turn into cynicism. And there's a fair number of cynical people in journalism. And
Same thing can happen in lobbying.
Well, absolutely. It happens in a lot of fields. So I said, okay, I want to use my skills, but I'm not sure I want to be a conventional journalist. So maybe publishing, other areas of that. So I came to Washington literally 40 years ago last week. My wife and I picked a city and said, okay, you can get a job in art. I can get a job in writing. Came to Washington. I lived in a group house, a bunch of random people, including Neil Cavuto of Fox Business News, who I used to know way back then, and he had an internship in the Jimmy Carter White House. That's another side story. And anyway, so I got to meet all kinds of interesting people. And I got a job.
Neil's been in D.C. that long?
Yes. Oh. Well, he was back then.
Yeah.
And he was a senior in college at the time. And anyway, so I got my first job, besides a restaurant job, which, you know, you have to do to make money, is with an association of wholesale florists, like as in flowers. And I got low pay and a great title. And I worked on the magazine and did PR for them for about a year and a half. Then I went away to work for the American.
What kind of PR do florists need?
Well, let me tell you. Back then it was about, you know, don't buy direct from retailers. Work through your wholesaler, right?
Oh, okay.
But it was also, you know, everything from prices and issues. Some years after I left, there was a big scandal about flowers being imported from Colombia with cocaine in the shipments. And I'm like, I can't believe I missed that story. I'm actually glad I missed that story. So we did that. And, you know, basically what I was trying to do is get some good clips, having written for a magazine, you know, to get the next job. Unfortunately, there was a recession and the Washington Star folded right around then. So I'm like, wow, it's going to be tough. But I got a job with the American Gas Association as a senior editor at a pretty young age. And then I thought I'd do it for a few years and be an energy writer. And then I kept getting promoted and new responsibilities every few years. And before I knew it, I'd been there a while and found I really liked the energy business and natural gas, that's also legal now, is natural gas.
That's right.
Natural gas is, you know, the cleanest of fossil fuels. And we would do things with environmental groups and studies and research about, you know, dealing with issues of carbon in the atmosphere. And you could talk about some of that stuff. And I liked the members a lot. So I stuck around and wound up doing running communications and having almost as big a staff there as I now have with the consul. And then, you know, as all things happen, job is like a roller coaster ride and there's peaks and valleys, and I'd had a good run. And finally I said, okay, it's really time to do something else. And that's when I fortunately was hired to join the consul. And I was the first person outside the organization brought in to run the organization. And I was 40 and I looked about 28. And I remember going before the search committee, and an elder guy who was the head of the search committee, mid-60s, he asked the question you're not supposed to ask in the first. He said, how old are you? And I said, you know, I'm 40. Well, what I didn't mention is I had just turned 40 that week. So it was a real difference to have someone so young and outside the public affairs field, coming from communications of all places, to run the public affairs consul. But I, you know, I had done public affairs work. And, you know, when you're working in that area in communications for a trade association, it's all in support of advocacy of one type or another. So I kind of knew that area and how to tie it together. So I came to the consul and I've been there
ever since.
Since 97. And it's great.
How does 2020 look for you, for the public affairs council? Anything exciting on the,
Well, we're going to continue to expand our public opinion research. We're looking toward, if not this year, the following year, you know, doing some more polling in Europe as well as in the U.S. on attitudes toward business and government. We've been doing more sort of thought leadership polling. We did a great study a year ago on how the public perceives crises and controversies, and that got a lot of traction in the communications field as well. Everyone faces controversies, but not everyone faces a major crisis. And one of the things we found, and we did this in conjunction with Morning Consult, is that the way the brain processes a corporate layoff or a corporate scandal that isn't even that serious, it's the same way as if it's a major crisis. You know, they talk about no longer doing business with you, maybe say bad things about you, your favorability rating goes down. So the lesson there is that you got to pay attention to reputation and how it affects everything you do. So we're going to probably do some more work in that space. So that's one area. You know, we're looking to build our conferences, make them larger, more international. We do a major membership satisfaction survey starting this month. We take that very seriously. We even compute a net promoter score, you know, to see how we're viewed, whether people would recommend us to others. That leads into our strategic plan, and we'll be producing that. And I guess the last thing I'd mention is every few years, we do a major benchmarking survey where we survey 150 companies on how they staff public affairs, how they fund it, you know, budgets, you know, percentage of budget spent on consultants, you know, coalitions, how well you work with your business and trade associations. And that data is then used for customized analyses that members will pay us to produce to see, okay, among pharmaceutical companies, how do I rank? How are we doing? And it helps give people some sort of benchmark for their own performance goals, and to sometimes it gives them the ammunition to expand their staff and expand their services. I would say in general, this is a fascinating field. It's getting more and more difficult, although in ways that will probably preserve the profession. Political risk as a an area of concern in business. There's a recognition that this is a huge deal, and more companies are paying attention to legislation and, you know, regulatory threats and the whole business environment. And are we vulnerable or not? Even like when President Trump puts tariffs on, takes tariffs off, the point I've been making to media in interviews is that it's the uncertainty that creates great political risk. It's not knowing what's next and how do you plan, you know, expanding facilities or hiring people when you're not sure about where public policy is going. So part of our audience is public policymakers and others to say, you know, companies need to know the rules of the game in order to be successful. And you'd be doing our economy a huge favor if there was a greater level of predictability about where policy is going. So lots of interesting stuff going on, especially during an election year.
Well, Doug, it was great to have you come by. I feel like we have just scratched the surface. I think we're going to have to circle back and maybe interview some members of your team and dig down a little bit. It's just great to have you come by and great to hear about your career and the Public Affairs Council.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed the conversation and I look forward to speaking with you again.
All right. Thanks, Doug.
There it is. Thanks for listening. Remember, you can sign up for our Monday morning email, Coffee with the Lobbying Show, at our website, thelobbyingshow.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at The Lobbying Show. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. And please subscribe to our show wherever it is that you listen to your podcast, on Apple, Google, or Spotify. Hope you enjoyed the show. See you next week.